Welcome to TWT FM, a podcast from The World Transformed, an annual festival and year-round political education project committed to delivering political education across the UK in order to build a movement capable of radically transforming society.
We'll be releasing weekly podcasts across September to coincide with this year's festival, looking at the big topics with a wide-angle lens you'd expect from TWT.
You can now register for a festival pass and view the full September programme at theworldtransformed.org.
But for now, turn up your headphones, sit back and listen up. This is The World Transformed. The coronavirus crisis has seen many people fall into rent arrears, and with the temporary eviction ban due to have ended by the time you're hearing this show, Britain could see a huge increase in the number of people being made homeless. This comes on the back of a decade of austerity, with its erosion of services and safety nets that would prevent people from becoming homeless. But homelessness itself is not an inevitability. In fact, mass street homelessness in Britain is a relatively modern phenomenon. To begin this episode, we spoke to Professor Danny Dorling to find out more on the history of homelessness.
Outside of capitalist societies, or a time when capitalism was dominant, homelessness was incredibly rare, as far as we can tell from the historical record. There was no need for homelessness. You had a home if you were settled, if you were farming, and if you weren't settled, your home was where you moved to. Capitalism turns land into property. It is owned by particular people, and there is no questioning over their right to own it. And furthermore, capitalism rewards those who are most greedy. And so that property, that land, becomes held in fewer and fewer hands. There's not much point holding the land if you can't make money from it. And there are various ways in which you can make money, but one way is that you can actually rent out properties on it to people. And so until about 100 years ago, the vast majority were renting to be able to live somewhere. And if they couldn't pay the rent, they would become homeless. It's only in the last century that actually being able to borrow an enormous amount of money and try and pay it back over 25 or 30 or 35 years to allow you to buy a property and become your own, if you like, mini capitalist, has become possible. Capitalism also requires people to work and to do jobs where they're not paid as much as they're actually making, so that somebody can rip them off and make a bigger profit. Now, how do you get people to do work which they usually don't enjoy and which they're certainly not paid as much as their bosses are making out of them working? Fear. Fear is the way. If you don't work, if you don't get a job, if you don't do as you're told, then you won't have enough money for the rent, and you and your family will become destitute. If we allowed people to be able to live without fear of losing their home, many people would choose not to do jobs they hate. So homelessness is actually used as a weapon to keep capitalist society going, particularly in the most extreme capitalist countries. So the greatest homelessness that you will see is in the United States. Thousands and thousands of homeless people in large cities, United States. Across Europe, the most extreme capitalist country is the United Kingdom, and in particular England. And across Europe, the highest number and rate of homelessness is in the United Kingdom. The only other country in Europe with a similar number of people on the streets, or which used to have a similar number of people on the streets as the United Kingdom, was Germany. But that was only because Germany had recently admitted 1.5 million Syrians, and a very small number of those 1.5 million Syrians were living on tents under motorway flyovers. So there is a variation within capitalism. The history of homelessness under capitalism is long and complex. It begins with the enclosure movement and the enclosure of land by those who are most powerful to allow them to create larger fields to make a greater profit in terms of agriculture. This dispossessed the land and the commons from people in England in particular, and forced many to walk to cities to find somewhere to live and somewhere to work. It also forced huge numbers to emigrate. It creates vagrants. And in 1824, we had a Vagrancy Act outlawing being vagrant, even if you're forced to be homeless. And this act is still used today to move people on, to convict them. The Poor Law comes in later in the 19th century, and the workhouse is used as a threat. If you're found homeless, you could be put into the workhouse, literally imprisoned and forced to work for nothing. But then later on, things do begin to improve. We begin to get local authority housing, first of all in very small amounts. And then after the First World War, we get the first kind of homes for heroes being built. But also during the First World War, we had rent strikes. People refused to pay the rent because they couldn't afford to pay the rent, because in most cases their husbands were fighting a war and not there earning money. And legislation began to come into Parliament to give people rights not to be evicted from their homes. And that legislation became stronger and stronger and stronger, to a point where you really had the right to enjoy your rented home as long as you could pay the rent, and the rent could not be unreasonably increased. Tragically, that was unwound, taken back in time by Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s. She introduced the Basic Tenancy Agreement, which most tenants now have, the Assured Shorthold Tenancy Agreement, whereby you can be given just 8 weeks' notice that you're going to be evicted, whereby your landlord can increase your rent by as much as they like, which is a way of evicting you very, very easily. And in recent decades, in the last 20 years, every year, it's been evictions under the Assured Shorthold Tenancy that have added more and more and more to the reasons why people are roofless, the most extreme form of homelessness on the streets. However, there is another really, really important reason why we have high rates of homelessness now, historically, and that is income and wealth inequality. We were a very unequal country 100 years ago. We became more and more equal throughout the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, and 1970s. So that by the 1970s, the best off 1% after tax only had four times as much as the average person. And then inequality was allowed and driven to rise up again in the 80s, 90s, 2000s under Blair, it rose, and throughout the 2010s. Now, why does this matter for housing and homelessness? It matters because when you look at how well we share out our housing in Britain, you find that it was most unequal in the last 100 years in 1921, in the 1921 census. And then the distribution of housing, the distribution between people and bedrooms, becomes more equal up until the 1981 census. Where we were the best housed, the most equally housed we had ever been. And of course, we had a very large amount of council housing then. The majority of children in the 1940s grew up in a council house in Britain. It was not unusual. It was a normal thing to do. From the 1980s onwards, the distribution of people to housing became more and more unequal. More people ended up owning second homes, third homes. More affluent young professionals end up just on their own in an ex-council house in London, which used to house four people, and more people end up overcrowded. So the situation today is we have never had as many bedrooms in the UK as we have now, as many spare bedrooms per person. Even in London, there are more bedrooms than there are people. So if nobody wanted to share a bed with anybody else in London, we could house everybody in London. That inequality in income and wealth has really, really driven part of the housing problem, as well as allowing landlords to simply do what they wish, evict people at will. And landlords are aiming to make as much money as they can. So if they can rent a property to one person who will pay more rent than a family of four who have less money and will pay less rent, they'll rent that property to one person. You can immediately see what goes wrong. Homelessness creates what is seen as a policing problem for the authorities. And the way in which this has been managed has varied over time. I'm told by an authority on homelessness in London who's looked at the records in central London around Charing Cross that in 1947, 48, 49, 1950, there were almost no homeless people in the middle of London. Don't think that homelessness has always been with us. But then, as homelessness began to rise, and particularly when social support was taken away from 16 and 17-year-olds so they could find themselves on the streets in the 1980s, the authorities became more and more closely involved. A lot of it was trying to move people on, move people away. So in rural areas and in affluent areas, homeless people are chased away by the police and other services. So they have to move towards the poorer part of town where they can't be seen, where there won't be any embarrassment. We also have legislation to avoid us being embarrassed or upset. So children cannot legally be homeless. They'll be taken by social services and housed. People with extreme mental illness can be taken off the streets and looked after. And the elderly, once you're qualified for a state pension, you can be housed. So we have legislation so that the so-called kind of undeserving age groups are allowed to sit there as a warning. And it's heavily policed. And it isn't just policed by the police. It's also policed by homeless charities who, you know, often, of course, involve people who want to do good. But they now are a permanent feature of the landscape. They make a lot of money. They often get grants from government. They employ a lot of people. And they kind of keep the situation rolling around by going around and taking people off, helping them to get into hostels for a time. But then they can often end up back on the streets. There is a better way, and the better way is the way which has been piloted in some parts of Britain, but unfortunately without everything else that you require to make it work. And the better way is called Housing First, which was originated in Finland, where the first thing you do is offer somebody housing. And only after that do you worry whether they have an addiction or some other problem, and you deal with those things. Now, that's a very different model of policing homelessness.
Thanks to Danny Dorling for that insight. Danny has a new book, Fintopia, published on the 24th of September. Be sure to get yourself a copy. Squatting has been made almost impossible in recent years by severe legislation criminalising those who participate, but the action of taking unused buildings to home those in need is a direct response to the problems of housing that should be celebrated. Here's Penny Grennan from Tynedale Transformed, broadcasting from inside a local lockdown with a handy historical guide.
A short history of squatting.
London's communist squatters continue to fill the headlines, and at the Ivanhoe Hotel, it looked as if the whole situation was being hotted up. When our cameramen went there, the squatters were inside and apparently under siege. Anyway, they were getting their comrades or sympathisers to throw in food from the streets.
Although the squatting of land and housing in the UK goes back centuries, it is only in the 20th century that a modern squatters movement came into its own. After World War II, a wave of squatting began. First in empty army camps and then in empty expensive properties, such as the Duchess of Bedford's house in Kensington or the Ivanhoe Hotel in Bloomsbury. A demonstration on September the 14th, 1946, saw 12,000 people march behind the banner, "Ex-servicemen demand requisition of all empty mansions and luxury flats." This campaign was not only in response to the number of homes damaged in the war, but to the widespread slum conditions of privately rented homes. From 1968 onwards, a new squatting movement had begun. Different squatter campaigns first symbolically squatted empty luxury flats at the Hollies in Wanstead and Arundel Court in Notting Hill. Then they moved to occupy empty homes in Redbridge, moving homeless families in and defending the houses physically from violent bailiffs, but also legally from eviction. The London Squatters Campaign was thus born, with lots of press and TV publicity. In late 1969, the media went mad when the countercultural London Street Commune initiated three large empty central London squats, the most famous being at number 144 Piccadilly.
144 Piccadilly. They attempted to defy law and order. They thought they could snub the conventions of decent society when they seized the 60-room mansion and transformed it into hippie house. For a week, several hundred dropouts took up residence. They decided to stay put and meet violence with violence, despite an eviction order. Fortunately, violence was kept to a minimum when they were cleared out.
press hysteria about drug-taking layabouts tried to turn what was a rough mix of hippies and young homeless people seeking alternative ways of living into public enemy number one. By 1973, there were still an estimated 100,000 empty public and private homes in London alone, 30,000 people in temporary hostels or B&Bs, and 2,000 street homeless. From these two campaigns in the 1970s started a mass wave of squatting, mostly concentrated in the inner cities, but also rurally, as some people sought a way out of the daily grind. This was a housing movement, responding to a housing crisis by squatting empty homes for housing, campaigning and making demands. Throughout the 70s and 80s, squatting continued with an estimated 30,000 to 50,000 people squatting in the UK at any one time. Squatters were made up of those who were organised and promoted squatting via local groups, publications and practical help, and those who were occupying empty buildings independently outside of what could be described as the squatters' movement. Part and parcel of this movement was the energy and solidarity that squatters brought to different areas of London and other cities, and the political crossover that occurred when squatters involved themselves in struggles such as claimants' unions, women's refuges, lesbian and gay rights, fighting the selling off of council houses, and general community activism. The squatting movement consistently provided meeting spaces, cultural activities, food co-ops, cheap cafes, and the attempt to create alternative ways away from the daily 9-to-5 routine. Not only this, but squatters pioneered the turning of squats into housing co-ops, mostly on a short life basis, but some are still in existence today, such as the Abiona House Housing Co-op, established in 1975 in Hampstead. By the mid-1980s, many squatters had turned to occupying the thousands of local council flats that were empty as a result of long-term neglect due to cuts in funding and council's mismanagement of its housing stock. A vibrant squatting movement continued until the late 2010, despite increasingly difficult conditions. Quicker evictions, fewer and fewer empty buildings due to the gentrification of London, the clampdown on welfare benefits, the rising cost of living and stagnating wage levels. Despite media panics around travellers, rave parties, foreign squatters and some changes in the law and rules affecting squatting in 1977, 1994 and 2001, it was only in 2012 that Section 144 of the Legal Aid, Sentencing and Punishment of Offenders Act created a new offence of squatting in a residential building. It is not illegal to squat in a commercial building, although landlords can use other laws on criminal damage to evict squatters. The link between widespread homelessness and plentiful empty property as the basis of squatting is not direct, and other factors contribute to the scale and nature of the squatting movement. On the one hand, it depends upon the extent to which property owners and the state are prepared to use the police, the courts, harassment to defend establishment property rights. On the other hand, the success of squatting depends on the ability of squatters and other homeless people to organise effectively and to obtain support from other sections of the community. So what is the future of squatting? Although the squatting movement has shrunk as a result of the new law, it continues still in empty commercial properties and in challenges to the law via protest squats, working with local housing groups to resist gentrification.
My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? Come on, tell me, baby. In the pond, where the sun don't ever shine. I bet she loved you all night too.
Thanks, Penny. And thanks to Mayday Rooms and 56A Info Shop for their pamphlet on practical histories of squatting, from which that history drew. At the start of this month, we went down to London's East End to catch up with a collective of different housing rights groups on a walking tour demo around Shoreditch and Hackney. Here's what went down.
Protect the homeless!
As you can hear, we're getting some community support, which is always good. I'm one of the co-founders of the Labour Homelessness Campaign. Here, along with the Homes for All Alliance in Tower Hamlets, we're doing what we're calling the Tour with No Fixed Abode. And as a coalition of groups, we are highlighting the fact that while people are sleeping rough on the streets, while they are being criminalised and, you know, forced out of our public spaces, there are buildings sat completely empty.
Homes for people, not for profit.
Homes for people, not for profit.
Homes for people, not for profit.
What are we doing here tonight?
Well, we're having a little walk through the East End, basically, from Bethnal Green, where we were talking about empty homes. And now we're in Hackney, where we're talking about the people who are in the way are the victims of the empty homes, which is the homeless.
In the UK, there's 218,000 empty homes. And we recently, obviously with COVID, we've had to bring in the homeless people, which was 15,000. Like, if you do the maths, there's plenty of homes for these people. It's bang out of order that they're still on the streets. Some didn't even make it into the hotels, with confirmation that over 16,000 actually contacted the outreach teams. So, you know, this government is taking liberties, not housing these people, especially vulnerable people that have got addictions and mental health issues. They need support. So, yeah, that's why I'm here today.
There's, you know, £10 billion in empty properties in London, which is just the clearest sign that our whole housing system is being run for profit and not for people. A lot of us who are organising this work or volunteer in homeless hostels, and we've sort of seen that while there were a lot of people brought in under shelter during the COVID-19 pandemic, right now those hostels are closing. Particularly migrants with no recourse to public funds are in huge danger of being forced out onto the streets because the government is not giving any funding. Councils are facing a £10 billion black hole in their budgets, and really the most vulnerable in society are not the priority. It's an easy solution. All we have to do is fill these empty buildings with the people who need homes.
Okay, so we're stopping here at the Shuttleworth Hostel because it is an example of everything that is wrong. The Shuttleworth Hostel in 2016, on the 15th of June, is where Joseph Coughlin was found dead. He'd been in his room for 3 days before his body was found. That is the level of care we're talking about in temporary accommodation. Since then, there have been 3 more deaths. Guests staying here have reported seeing people leave this property in body bags. It receives payments from Hackney, Tower Hamlet, Newham and Camden Councils. And between June to November 2018 alone, they received £1.38 million in council funding.
And why do you think this is a particularly important campaign right now?
We're at risk of 500,000 more people becoming homeless due to the rent situation that's been exacerbated by COVID. And also because, I mean, it's been an important issue for the last 10 years, in my opinion. And like last year, 497 recorded rough sleepers died. And as someone who was a specialist outreach worker and knew personally 3 of those people that died, and then to imagine 497 people, I don't know, it's just wrong, and the housing situation doesn't help, and it's always been important. It's been important for 10 years, but in this current country with its richness, like, it just shouldn't be happening.
You know, we had a housing crisis before COVID, and we're going to have a housing crisis after it, and it's going to carry on until or unless we manage to build campaigns that can force government to change policy, because otherwise we are just going to keep going around this circle. And you know, it's destroying lives. And that is, you know, that's not exaggeration. It's destroying lives, it's costing lives, just as COVID is doing. So we need to make those connections, really, and really build campaigns that can't be ignored anymore.
And how would you like to see this campaign grow? What do you think is the next stage?
I mean, I think forming alliances is what it's all about. You know, I've been involved in housing campaigns for longer than I care to think about. But, you know, far too often we're working in our own little patches. We're not linking in with each other enough. I think we, as housing campaigners, we punch beneath our potential weight, really. And so tonight is good because myself, I've been involved with a campaign called Homes for All and Defend Council Housing. Tonight, we're very happy to be working with the Labour Homelessness Campaign. And that, to me, is the way forward.
We need care, not criminalisation. We need care,
If people want to get involved in this kind of activism, what are the channels through which they should do that?
Just reach out to your local community. Like, there is, what I've learned is that there's so many different groups and that they're so easy to get involved in. Like, you literally only have to click attending on a Facebook Zoom call and you're already part of the team. Yeah. And you can have so much impact so quickly, and you can learn so much from so many beautiful people so quickly, and like, it's actually fun. So don't think about how, just do, and just go and just join and just learn. And yeah, we spend too much time thinking about what's wrong with what we're doing, and we need to just, you know, do something.
We heard voices there from our friends at Homes for All and Labour Homelessness Campaign, who helped us in putting this episode together, and for which we want to say thank you. The next piece we're going to hear is a testimony collected from the Museum of Homelessness National Collection for Homelessness. The collection includes objects that reveal a different real-life story about homelessness, health and inequality in the UK. The collection has been built over the last 4 years with stories coming from Manchester, Glasgow, London and elsewhere. The museum have kindly let us reproduce some of the work here, for which we're grateful. The following is from a film by Dorothy Allen Pickard and is performed by Ben Smithies.
This is a naloxone kit. It was donated by a volunteer at the Simon Community, Scotland.
What I've got in my hand is naloxone. Naloxone kind of signifies it, but it's an opiate. It brings you to overdose. It's an opioid antagonist.
No. For people that use heroin and methadone on the streets, lots of people, obviously there are lots of drug-related deaths in Glasgow, no? So for me it's kind of quite significant because throughout my life I was an addict. I am an addict. I'm a heroin addict. I'm in recovery, no. But I had that used on me once and it brought me back. Well, that had been dead. But since I've gotten to recovery and I've started volunteering with the Simon community, I've had to administer it twice to do two different service users. One, I had to get CPR and that, and then I had to administer naloxone to him, no? And the other one was a young lassie. She came in and she was in a state of overdose, no? And I saved her life, really. And what it does is, obviously, they've took heroin, probably other drugs too, no? But the heroin will kill them, so you gain naloxone and it attacks the opiate receptor and it puts a cover on it and it stops the heroin having any effect, no? Only for, 20 minutes it lasts, but in that 20 minutes you're on the phone, you've got the paramedics coming, so they come and kind of finish off the job, and I saved her life. It was kind of good, you know. You know what I mean? It was, it made everything worthwhile. Legal high NPS. You know, it's a problem for the younger ones just coming through because they got their own perception of legal, and they think because it was legal, but now there's a blanket ban on it, but it'll come, you know, we'll see the effects of that. Maybe in 10 years, it'll be rife, you know what I mean? By that time, but by that time they'll develop new drugs to bring into Glasgow, and it's just going to be crazy. In 10 years' time, we're all going to be, really, we're going to suffer the consequences of this addiction. You know, addiction's going to be rife. Well, I think my story tells it all from where I was, sitting out there on the streets with a cup, walking about, as I say, it was cocaine at the end of my using. But, you know, my mental health wasn't good, so it was just walking in circles every night. I'd never sleep much.
Where I'm sitting here, having a conversation with you. It says it all, doesn't it, really?
Now, as I look around, it's mighty plain to see. This world is such a great and a funny place to be. Oh, the gambling man is rich and the working man is poor, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
Thanks again to the Museum of Homelessness, a great organisation you should check out. Next, we brought together activists from around the UK for a conversation comparing how the pandemic has affected their work and to reflect on their own personal experiences of being involved in homeless activism.
I live in Middlesbrough. I'm one of the co-founders of the Labour Homelessness Campaign. My name's Tom Zagoria.
Hi, I'm Andrea. I am from Putney and I'm currently the admin and logistics for the Labour Homelessness Campaign.
I'm Michelle Langan. I'm in Liverpool and I am the founder of the Paper Cup Project Charity, which is an outreach charity in Liverpool.
My name's Jane Clendon. I live in Hackney and I'm a part of Street Kitchens, and within that I've been coordinating the Hackney element of the Street Kitchens.
So yeah, I think it would be good to hear a little bit about how people got involved in homelessness work, including any lived experience that they'd feel comfortable sharing. Would we be able to start with you, Jane?
Yeah, sure. I sort of moved to London when I was 18. And I was introduced then to the squat scene in Brixton, sort of political-based squats, mainly with people from the non-stop picket against apartheid. So that was my first introduction and knowledge of sort of homeless community and squatting. I then continued and finished my nurse training, started working with people with HIV, and then found myself working quite closely with the homeless community that was accessing the services, and from there with drug users. I then had a period of homelessness myself, just because I was in between jobs and the contract I was going to, the housing contract, fell through last minute, so I found myself homeless within a day. I was already friends with a lot of my friends, were living in creative squats anyway, so I was picked up by the homeless safety net once again. Also, I had massive traumas sporadically through my whole life, and the people that could talk to me about them in great depth, so I had a lot of friends that were nurses, doctors, physios, who were real proper friends, but it was too much for people often, so you find they didn't know how to support you or what to say, so they'd say nothing. Well, the homeless people were completely and utterly the opposite, and people that had the greatest need and had nothing gave the most. And that's been my experience my whole life, really. Including from when I was quite young. So that's been my driving factor.
In 2012, I got evicted with my daughter due to rent arrears, and it took us years to get somewhere. We were in temporary accommodation and like the council kept refusing to give me somewhere. So in 2016, I decided to work with Crisis and, basically got in with them, volunteering as a general volunteer. And for the last 4 years, I've been volunteering with them. And I've recently just set up, as I've got my home now, I've recently set up a Wandsworth group for the London Renters Union. To ensure that it doesn't happen to anybody else, because being evicted is not great at all, and you're constantly thinking about what's going to happen, where you're going to go. Like they put me all over the UK basically, as temporary accommodation as well, which was a struggle getting my daughter to school at times. Sometimes my daughter even had to stay with family and friends so she could get to school. So it was a really difficult period for us, to be honest. But yeah, we're out of that now, and on to positive things.
Thanks very much, Andrea, and join a renters union, everyone, basically. Michelle, do you want to talk a little bit on kind of what got you involved?
I'd lived in London for a long time. I was 10 years in London, and then I came back to Liverpool and started to see more homeless people in Liverpool. And before I'd gone away, I'd not really seen that in Liverpool. We didn't really have a homeless problem. So I started seeing more homeless people around and thinking that I wanted to do something to help, but wasn't really sure how. So I started going out. There was just two of us in the beginning with a trolley and a flask, and we'd just go around and give sandwiches out. And we started sharing stories about people's situations on social media, on Facebook. And it kind of became quite powerful, and it was giving people a voice, and it kind of got people interested and wanting to get involved. So that's how we started, really. And now we've kind of grown to a team of volunteers of around 30 volunteers over the past 4 years.
I guess my own experience, I had sort of immediate family lived experience of homelessness, actually in the US, where you have a much smaller safety net of any kind of support, and sometimes, you know, even more like drastic criminalization. You see sort of homeless encampments just being cleared out with bulldozers and people being crushed in tents, and that's kind of an everyday thing in large parts of America. And we're kind of starting to see similar things over here in some cases. So then I got involved in the UK in squatting campaigns, a bit like Jane, in kind of anti-criminalization campaigns, and you just see how all of these things really fit together, and how people are being cleared out of city centers in favor of kind of capital. I think it would be good to talk a bit about kind of what you've been doing during lockdown and what you've sort of seen on the ground. I suppose these things usually start with London, but should we start with Liverpool this time? Michelle, do you want to talk a little bit about what's been going on there?
So as it was approaching lockdown, Liverpool City Council acted quite quickly, actually. I think they were one of the first councils to take people inside. So before the government had even announced that that was kind of what they wanted local authorities to do, Liverpool had already started the process of getting people inside. So throughout the whole of lockdown, we've been in conversation with the council to find out kind of what the long-term plan is and whether people are still inside. And I have to say, it's been quite positive in Liverpool. I know that around the country, it's not the same story, unfortunately. But we seem to have seen quite good results in Liverpool. And over this past month, some of the people are starting to move into permanent accommodation. The social housing providers have suspended bringing in tenancy applications because they're just at the moment concentrating on providing accommodation for permanent accommodation for our homeless. So it's good at the moment, fingers crossed.
That's good to hear. I suppose maybe it's worth going to potentially the other extreme in a true blue Tory Wandsworth. I don't know, Andrea, if you want to talk a bit about, because you've been working there in a shelter as well, haven't you?
Yeah, so at the beginning of lockdown, I had the opportunity to work with St Mungo's and Crisis at the Wandsworth Hotel. I did about 3 shifts there. This hotel was run by Sadiq Khan. And we had about 129 people from across London. They weren't from Wandsworth. So in April, I moved on to the actual Wandsworth Hotel, which is in Putney. And so far, we have looked after 60 homeless people, and we've had over 70 volunteers come and volunteer with us. So we're providing meals, toiletries, clothes. Like, we're not getting any support from the council whatsoever. And they're basically taking the credit for the work that we've literally done as well, which is quite insulting.
So these are the hotels that have been set up as sort of emergency, like hotels converted into emergency homeless accommodation as part of the Everybody In scheme by the government, which was sort of announced with a lot of fanfare. And the entire sort of national scheme around this seems to be in a bit of trouble. But the one thing the government's been on sort of top form on during this crisis seems to have been media management, because like Andrea, you said, they've taken quite a lot of credit for all the work being done really at the grassroots level. I wonder, Jane, would you be able to speak a bit more about the work that you've been doing across multiple councils, right, with trying to, you know, get everybody in and make sure everyone's fed during this?
We had an absolute visible increase in people presenting new to the streets or sort of first time, literally rough sleeping. Many of the hidden homeless were presenting onto the streets, hadn't navigated homeless systems before and really just didn't have a clue about what their rights were or how to access services. We were picking these people up outside of the street kitchens, doing walkabouts. main problems we picked up immediately, which were overwhelming, was our homeless people had no access to drinking water. Now, with cafes, restaurants, everything shut, water fountains all closed, toilets shut, there was literally no access to water. There was no funds made available for bottled water. There's big problems about having any shared water because of COVID. It's just not allowed. It has to be sealed. So this fell down on us bringing it up with the council. Council picked it up straight away, but it still took 4 to 6 weeks for them to actually get any water at all. So that came down to street kitchens. So we got 6 pallets and then more. So we were literally distributing water. But what led me to that was going to London Fields, where quite a few people were sleeping. And a few of the cafes were nice there, and there was a guy drinking out of the toilet cistern. So it really honestly was that bad.
So yeah, I guess one last question that I have for everyone. What do you see happening next? Because I guess there are really different things that we've sort of talked about. On the one hand, there's been huge amounts of work getting people off the streets who we'd never have imagined would get off the streets before. So there's maybe signs of hope there. But on the other hand, we're obviously these massive economic pressures and this kind of tidal wave of shit that's the end of the eviction ban about to hit us. So how do those things balance? How much hope do you have for the future? And, you know, what do you think needs to happen next?
Personally, what I've seen over this whole pandemic is the fact that homelessness can be solved. You know, the government can resolve homelessness. And they proved at the beginning where they said, you know, everybody needs to get inside. We're going to we're telling all the local authorities this is what's going to happen, and everybody gets inside. Now, it took a pandemic for that to happen. It's a ridiculous situation that in 2020, in a rich country, we're a rich country, that we have got people living on the streets. It's just absolutely disgusting. So I think what everybody has to remember is this can be done, and we need to push so that it is done.
I think that now the government need to focus on actually finding long-term accommodation for these people, and they can only do that by building more council homes and also, you know, sorting out the issues within the private rent sector as well, because obviously with so many up for eviction, like, it's only going to get worse with the amount of people that are going to end up on the street. So I think that, yeah, mass building of council homes and, you know, continuing to suspend the rents of those that are not able to pay their rent currently would be the best option for us moving forward.
Many thanks to Tom and Andrea from Labour Homelessness Campaign, Michelle from Paper Cup in Liverpool, and Jane from Streets Kitchen in Hackney for that discussion. Not everyone who is homed lives in a house. Throughout the 70s and 80s, a large number of people in Britain went on the road in pursuit of an alternative way of living. Many of these people suffered greatly at the hands of the police, who destroyed their vans and buses, making them homeless, at the Battle of the Beanfield in 1985. Up next, we reflect on this violent action, which resulted in the biggest mass arrest since World War II, and for which those people received no compensation.
Battle of the Beanfield, 1985. But to understand that, you need to understand a bit of context. From the early 70s onwards, we'd seen in this country the development of the free festival scene. The free festival scene had come out of really the failure of the commercial rock music scene in the early 70s. Rock music festivals, as it turned out, were just too difficult to police at that time, and so it was hard for people to make money. And so music festivals had become really the cultural form associated with the counterculture and alternative culture in Britain. And over the course of the 70s, they were treated as relatively harmless by the authorities and the press. But by the early 1980s, the atmosphere in the country was becoming much more tense. And also the scene was developing past the point where it could just be ignored.
The peace convoy had started out as a very ad hoc collection of people who lived peripatetically around festivals and the festival year, the highlight of which was Stonehenge Free Festival. And that attracted lots of people who I think felt very much in opposition to the political programme of the time and had been looking for a way out of it. And so the peace convoy of people who went from festival to festival and had a sort of quasi-bucolic existence in horse and carts, sometime around the mid-80s became known as the convoy. And as well as the horse and cart travel existence, it was joined by repurposed vans, repurposed ambulances, repurposed military vehicles in some cases.
One of the strongest forms of a home that the travellers had was their community, and it was the really incredibly strong relationships that they had with each other. Then another sense of their home was the land, particularly around southwest England. And then another thing, of course, was their caravans and their vans and the spaces that the kind of mobile spaces they lived in.
Well, we don't want to be split up. We don't want to be arrested.
I'm not going to leave my husband, my dog, my puppies and my home.
But we don't want to be arrested. If we leave here, we'll get arrested and split up. She'll be taken one place, I'll be taken another. We'll probably lose our home, but we'll have no livelihood, nowhere to live. We just want to get off this field as peacefully and as quietly as we can and just go, leave the county.
At the same time, from 1979, you got the Thatcher government, which is taking a much more aggressive attitude towards any form of opposition or resistance to its political, social and cultural project. So Thatcher engages in a series of violent confrontations, or her government deliberately provokes and encourages a series of violent confrontations, really between police and a range of different social political constituencies. Between 1980 and 85. First, the police provoke a violent confrontation with the black community in cities like London, Liverpool, Manchester. Then, most famously, Thatcher provokes and eventually wins a violent confrontation with the unions, culminating in the miners' strike of 1984. And then finally, in 1985, she abolishes the Greater London Council in London, brings in measures to effectively abolish various local authorities where local government is run by left-wing Labour people. And also Wiltshire police engage in a violent confrontation with the peace convoy in a beanfield in Wiltshire in 1985.
The Druids have left, the hippies arrive. And for one day of the year, officialdom forgets that no one's allowed within the stones. The mystery of Stonehenge is open to all.
Stonehenge was in occupancy for almost the whole of June by up to 100,000, 40,000 at times, 100,000 in total people, basically encamped at Stonehenge. It had stages, lights, everything.
We were going to start Stonehenge 1985 Free Festival with the intention of putting on a festival for the working class people of Britain, and we were stopped violently by the police, by the army and by the state.
I could see there was the potential for a really nasty bust-up between the convoy trying to go to the festival at Stonehenge and the Wiltshire establishment, including the police, trying to stop them. So I was with the convoy as a whole when it met up in Savernake Forest that Friday night. And I was with them on the Saturday morning as they started travelling towards Stonehenge and were stopped and broke through the hedge into this farmer's bean field. And so then I was one of the very few outsiders. What I saw was an act of organised bullying, some of it really quite vicious.
Nobody has to go where they don't want to go, yeah?
Good.
Nobody tells them they have to go onto the festival site. It's a quiet festival. We leave the society alone. They leave us alone.
They say that you've been throwing bricks and people have been hurt.
Look at the guy that just had to leave the site, yeah?
Grown men carrying sticks and riot shields and helmets to protect themselves attacked men, women and children who were not armed and who were almost defenceless. Flight in their vehicles was their only form of defence. And I saw some of their homes catching fire and burning, and I saw some of them being hit, and all of them, I think, were arrested.
Special courts are sitting in Salisbury to start hearing charges against more than 500 people arrested yesterday near Stonehenge in Wiltshire. They were on their way to an illegal pop festival. Police had thrown a security cordon around the site. Most of the arrests were made when hippies in what they called a peace convoy tried to break through police roadblocks.
The police that we were dealing with the same police that had been used in the miners' strikes. So they were in their 30s. They all had dodgy pawn tashes. They wore their uniform in a certain way. And then the reinforcements turned up and they were all 17, 18-year-old boys with soldiers' haircuts, and they all wore their uniform in a very different way.
There's a famous story which illustrates the relationship between, say, the miners' strike and the attack on the peace convoy, which is that sometime in 1984, which was a year when if you were on the motorways in Britain, you would see coachloads of police driving around, being driven from one pit to another to help suppress miners and to help break picket lines. And there's a famous story that the peace convoy was going one way on a motorway, probably heading from north to south, and a fleet of coaches full of police was going the other way. And some of the police at the back of one of the coaches wrote on a sign and held up a sign for the people in the peace convoy to see. And the sign said, "You're next."
It was entirely deliberate. It came a year after Orgreave, after she had closed down the mines and made so many people in the north unemployed and destroyed their way of life. She then very, very deliberately set out to put an end to travellers' lifestyles and to public gatherings and to free festivals. Thatcher was really cracking down on how you could inhabit space in a kind of alternative, off-grid way. And so for a lot of the travellers, they then ended up living in homes which wouldn't have been their choice. There was, you know, living as a traveller, is a very deliberate life choice, of course.
It's not as if the peace convoy was seen as a huge social threat. It wasn't like they were a big political problem for Thatcher. But, yeah, you couldn't have people like running around visibly, fragrantly, you know, rejecting the aspirational, individualistic values of Thatcherite society.
So she very, very deliberately wanted to stop their whole way of life. And it was about getting people on grid. It was about her economic intentions. You know, it's also just, I think, a disdain for their culture.
In 2015, one of the breakout hits of the Edinburgh Festival was a piece of documentary theatre combining live performance and film by Breach Theatre about their attempts to stage a reenactment of the Battle of the Beanfield 30 years on.
And we started talking about a way of marking the 30th anniversary of the Battle of the Beanfield through some kind of multimedia or documentary theatre show. And we've been involved in an occupation against tuition fees and also the general privatisation of universities. And then police came onto campus and used tasers to try and move students from a peaceful protest. The kind of frustrations that we were feeling with police and with the general corporatisation of public goods, public spaces. So it felt like a very kind of poignant moment to spend 6 months, I think it was, researching and making and then putting on the show. It's like, so you have all of these people who have experienced something that's incredibly traumatic and then has just been silenced. And then now we live in a state characterized by private renting, homelessness, and police managed access to cultural events such as festivals. And it's like, how did we get there? And in order to find alternate options, we do have to look to the past.
As the sun rose on the bean field, they came like a wolf on the fold. But no, they didn't give a warning. They took their bloody toll. I see the pregnant woman lying in blood and bone. I see the children.
We heard contributions from Jeremy Gilbert, Richard King, Dorothy Allen Pickard, Nick Davies and Carol Damaged. Thanks to Breach Theatre for kindly allowing us to reproduce some of their interview audio. At TWT, we try to cover a range of topics, and naturally, some things slip. We acknowledge that we could have done a better job at covering homelessness in the past. To address this issue, we talked to Shauna from the Labour Homelessness Campaign.
Okay. All right. So, my name's Charlie Clark. I'm the National Operations Coordinator for The World Transformed, and I also used to work as a support worker in a hostel for people who had been homeless.
And I'm Shauna, and I'm a homelessness activist.
I think it's maybe been noticeable, at least for myself, over the last 5 years. At TWT, we haven't done enough to centre issues around homelessness and homelessness activists. And I think possibly that's a broader issue on at least the Labour left, if not the broader movement. Why do you think that is?
The first thing worth noting is that, yeah, you're right, that definitely exists. There hasn't been enough attention put on homelessness. You can see that, like, looking specifically at TWT last year, it took place in Brighton, which has a huge number of people experiencing homelessness. At the same time that event was happening, you had Labour Homelessness Campaign working with other activists to push through kind of like landmark work on homelessness in that manifesto, really. You also had the fact that it was based in Brighton, which was one of the only kind of areas really taking up the Homeless Bill of Rights and at least discussing that and getting to that point. So the fact that that wasn't acknowledged within TWT is kind of proof and one example of how it isn't noticed enough on the left. And that's some ways in which it manifests itself, but you also see it in the fact that, like, you know, meetings to do with like political spaces either don't discuss homelessness enough or they don't make the space even accessible for people who are experiencing homelessness. So that could be anything from thinking about funds that you might need to make available for people to take part in meetings, recognizing, which of course is more difficult at the moment, that having digital online meetings doesn't work for everyone. Like, who are you excluding when you do that? So yeah, that's one part of how it manifests itself. In terms of like why it happens, I think there's a general thing around people categorizing themselves in their activism in a way that I think is really unhelpful. So I would say you kind of are seen as an activist, a political campaigner, or a volunteer. I think there are kind of three areas that exist or identities that people see themselves in. And that's really unhelpful because there's a lot of snobbery that comes with that. And specifically what I mean is that homelessness is an issue, is something that needs a lot of stuff doing right now. So an example would be the fact that every single night, Streets Kitchen, so grassroots groups like Streets Kitchen, are out sourcing food, serving food, having chats with people, giving people cups of tea, you know, getting tents to where they need to be, sleeping bags to where they need to be. And that's a very much like needs to be done now. So it takes away from the time that you have to look forward, which say something like The World Transformed and a lot of those kind of left political spaces are about. They're about like, what's our vision? How do we dream? How do we change? And that's really important. But how do you make space for that when you've got so much to do? And so these people who keep this running, and I want to be really clear that this work has been happening long before mutual aid existed. You kind of get stuck in that space and you're seen as a volunteer and it's seen as not radical. I think that's one of the elements that define or people define a volunteer to an activist as. And that this like definition of it not being radical, well, you know what, get yourself down to a Streets Kitchen because sadly in this world, like there is something radical about giving without asking any questions. And yeah, to be clear on that, if you were to go down to a food bank that the council have probably got their fingers involved in, you will be asked questions before you get access to food. Whereas grassroots groups like Streets Kitchen literally go to the streets and not ask people questions before you give people access to what everybody should have.
From your experience of organising around homelessness, what would you say are the utopian possibilities that are present there?
Oh my God, there's like so many utopian possibilities, right? I think one of the utopian possibilities is around changing how we see people or certainly how our acceptance level as a society. So the utopian vision there being that as we or if we all come together, we work to end homelessness, that is only possible if we learn to accept more people. Even though homelessness is a political choice, part of that whole kind of rationale in people's heads as they walk past somebody who might be street homeless is, oh, well, that's because they've had an addiction issue, or that's because of X. And they come up with these reasons that don't fall into what, as a society, we deem valuable or okay. And you can only change that. The solution isn't that all addiction goes away. The solution isn't that people stop drinking or that people stop taking drugs. It's that our tolerance as a society changes for that, that our acceptance level changes, that we accept that people come from a variety of different backgrounds, they have a variety of different experiences, and how people choose to live their lives can vary. So for me, that's a huge utopian vision.
Housing and land is really interesting because it's finite. You cannot make more and more of it. Norman Tebbit famously once said, when he was a lord in the House of Lords, and his chauffeur was having to drive him past mile upon mile of homes in central London where all the lights were off at night. Clearly nobody was living there. Norman Tebbit said, something's wrong where I can't actually live that near where I work in the House of Lords. Without realising that what was wrong was the system he'd created that make it possible for people to buy and own property that they don't occupy. And Norman Tebbit and Tony Blair really, really opposed things that would alter this. And they're relatively easy. Proportional taxing on housing. Rather than having a form of council tax, which taxes the poorest the most, and council taxes least in places like Westminster and Chelsea, actually taxing housing annually on how much it is worth to deter people from buying expensive property they don't need, and then taxing them even more if they don't live in that house and don't use that house, to encourage people not to hoard empty housing. And it sounds obvious, but we are governed by people who make money out of housing. A very, very large proportion of members of parliament are landlords, partly because they were encouraged to buy more houses by the expenses scheme used in the House of Parliament. And once you own property and rent it out to people, your attitude about other people changes. You begin to think it's okay to treat other people in a way that you wouldn't want to be treated yourself. And you also begin to think it's okay for you to provide a service like housing, even though you know nothing about housing when you become an amateur landlord. We wouldn't let anybody set up their own hospital without knowing what they're doing, or become a doctor without any qualifications. We would let somebody set up a school with no idea what they're doing. But in housing, and shelter is just as important to self and education, anyone, as long as they've got money, as long as they're rich, anybody can become your service provider. And that is utterly appalling.
You've been listening to TWT FM, a podcast from The World Transformed. If you could subscribe to the podcast and leave a review, that would really help other people discover the show. Right now at TWT, we're in the middle of our annual festival. And this year, for the first time ever, it's happening online and throughout the whole of September. And finally, if you've enjoyed this episode of TWT FM and would like us to continue producing the podcast after the TWT 20 festival is over, please consider supporting us at theworldtransformed.org/support. A regular donation equal to the cost of an hour's wage per month would really go a long way to help us continue creating important political education content like TWT FM all year round. That's theworldtransformed.org/support.